Dale's Other World goes to the Nature Museum this time around. And I want to talk about urban wildlife. So we've talked about wildlife in very wild places, but now we're going to the big city where people sometimes don't think wildlife exists. It sure as heck does. And you're still called the Academy of Sciences a bit?
That's right. We are the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum, and it's Chicago Academy of Sciences.
Steve Sullivan is the Senior Curator of Urban Ecology. It sounds very, very fancy. So here's where I want to start. It's an exhibit that kicks off soon at this museum. But even if you don't live in the Chicago area, this might be of interest to you because it's become a political issue. It's become a controversial issue. It's been called global warming. And now say, no, don't say it that way. It's got to be called climate change. No matter what it is it real, first of all?
Well, you know, this exhibit that we've put on, we call it From Weather to Climate, Our Changing World. And the reason we call it that is a lot of times we look out the window and we think, it's kind of warm today. I guess global warming's happening. Then we look out, it's kind of cold today. This climate change stuff's bogus. And so we really want to bring the rigorous science to families in an accessible way to help them all understand what is this climate change thing and is it real?
Well, that's the question, I guess. So we still want you to see the exhibit, but I want you to answer that question. I mean, is it real?
Well, the short answer is, quite frankly, it is. And as a Chicago Academy of Sciences, we've played a role in this. Back in the late 1800s, one of our board presidents was a glaciologist. He was studying, well, glaciers have obviously been here, and there are some up here in the northern latitudes and up high, but they're not down here low. What's going on with them? And as a simple part of his scientific analysis of glaciers, he realized that, you know, if we add CO2 to the atmosphere, we can change the climate. And this was just a simple data point. It was just a fact, and people built on that. And today, that's become one of the central understandings that we all have is, hey, as we add carbon to the atmosphere, the place can get warmer. And this carbon comes from ancient sunlight energy that was trapped by plants and is now in the form of coal and oil. So as we burn coal and oil, we're releasing this carbon that was trapped millions of years ago back into our atmosphere. And so it's not like the world's going to end necessarily because, quite frankly, there was lots of cool life that lived millions and millions of years ago. The real problem is it wasn't our kind of life and it wasn't our kind of lifestyle, and the world will be a miserable place for our species and many other species if it goes back to that kind of climate.
What kind of climate are we going to be worried about? And is this going to happen next week? It's not even in my calendar yet.
Well, that's one of the tough things about climate change is that it really is, in some respects, it's a complex science. I like to compare it to a Model T Ford. You know, if you're remotely mechanically inclined, you can kind of think of a Model T and figure out how it works, and all of that information can be contained within your head. But climate change is more like a modern supercar. There's not one single person on the planet that has all of the understanding of a modern supercar in their head. It takes lots of people. It takes lots of teamwork. And because this is a biological and geological issue, there's lots of issues facets of it that we just don't understand yet. We don't have the data for. It's really only been the past 100 or even 50 years that we've had enough data to really begin to put together models so we can begin to predict what the climate's going to be like in the future.
All right, you're a scientist, so you're not looking at it from a political perspective. Are you appalled that it's become a Democrat-Republican issue, that somehow climate change has gotten to be in America, not in other places in the world?
Yeah.
In this country, to my knowledge, we're alone here. Only in this country has it become a political issue. Other countries around the world either suggest, in most cases, it's real and we care about it. China says it's real. I'm not sure we care about it, I believe. But nevertheless, they even concede it's real.
Yeah, you know, it's pathetic that science has to be a political issue because politics can revolve around ideologies and perceptions and perspectives and how we grew up and things. But science is quite simply empirical study. You and I have equal opportunities to collect data points and understand things. One of the things I love is you look back at Benjamin Franklin. I think everybody can uniformly agree he was a great politician. probably because he never bothered to try to become president, right? But he collected phenological data. He looked out his window every spring and he said, hey, those Dutch tulips that I just imported for thousands of dollars are blooming on this particular day.
Okay, so we need to explain phenological data is based on how something looks?
Well, it's based on blooming times, basically. Benjamin Franklin would collect the blooming times of various plants near his house. And he just kept records of this, mostly, it seems, because he thought it was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But today, there's citizen science networks that keep track of this kind of data. And you as an individual and all your listeners can walk outside and say, hey, the Juneberries are blooming today. The tulips, the lilacs, they're blooming today. And then we can go back to the records of our ancestors who did the same thing, people who we trust, who didn't have a political agenda, and realize our flowers are blooming a little bit earlier this year than they were last year. And that may be just part of the weather. And this is a really important distinction to make. Weather, the analogy we make in our exhibit is weather is what you're wearing right now, but climate is your wardrobe. If you live in Hawaii, the chances are you don't have a big down parka and heavy boots because you live in a warm climate. In fact, though, if you climb Mauna Kea in Hawaii, you might need a down parka and boots.
Yeah.
So weather is a single data point. And really, in the grand scheme of hundreds and thousands of years, that single data point is immaterial. Climate, on the other hand, is a statistical and random analysis of those data points over a minimum of 30 years. And so we can look at the climate today, these last 30 years, and compare them to Benjamin Franklin's climate and realize that there is a change. It's an empirical change, and we can all see it. We don't need a politician to say whether it's true or not. And by looking at those simple aspects of things, those Model T Fords, if we can go back to that analogy, we can recognize that climate change is a real thing and that each and every one of us can do something about it.
Well, I want to get to what we can do about it in a moment. We could see it in other ways, too. So we may not go to Alaska every week, but there are people that do, mm-hmm. and people that live there. And they report, and people that live in northern Canada, that there's a problem here. I visited Australia last maybe 6 years ago. Clearly, everyone there was talking about it. And the hole in the ozone was and continues to seriously cause cancer, yeah. skin cancer, in a ginormous number of people there and also in New Zealand. I mean, climate change seems to be clear also based on, yes, you're right. I agree with you about the science that's there, but observation as well.
Personal experience goes a really long way to creating action based on climate change. But one of the challenges with that, you know, as you say, if you're living in the Southern Hemisphere, there's a huge chance that you're going to die of skin cancer because of stuff that you and I have done to the atmosphere. On the other hand, here in the Northern Hemisphere, as we've done a variety of surveys, we see that if it's warm outside today, people believe in climate change. If it's cold outside today, they don't believe it. In fact, there was one small study that showed that if it's warm inside, if you turn up the thermostat too much, people don't believe in climate change. And so we need to temper that personal experience and that, hey, my buddy said or my grandma said, and just look at the data and come to our own firm conviction that these data are actually saying something and it's useful and I need to do something about it.
Well, if we could ask polar bears, they would tell us about climate change, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. And the more
explain why I said that.
Well, the more extreme the environment, the easier it is to see changes. So polar bears are living in a place that ideally is frozen most of the year. They're called Ursus maritimus because they live over the oceans.
That's the scientific name for polar bears.
For polar bears, yeah. And you know, polar bears live in such extreme environments that they'll kill and eat seals, but they only eat the fat off the seals in some cases. They don't even eat the meat because to eat the meat would be sort of the equivalent of eating just salads all the time. You wouldn't get enough calories from it to stay warm.
Hmm.
And so when you're living in a place that's that cold and the temperature goes up just a couple of degrees, all of a sudden you start to really notice the changes. Unlike, you know, here in the Midwest where we see seasons all the time. And so it's a little colder this winter. It's a little warmer this winter. No big deal. The northern reaches, you really see the changes quickly.
And some of those changes, I guess, may be beneficial for individual people because the weather isn't so extreme. But it's not only extreme weather. And I know you're not a climatologist. You're a scientist,
right.
But not
mm-hmm.
a climatologist.
Correct.
Or a meteorologist. But the weather seems to, and we've experienced this right here in Chicago, but it's all over the world, has gotten crazy. So stuff that happens or is now happening that never happened before in certain parts of the world that happened in other parts of the world. You know what I'm saying? And now it's and as far as the polar regions go, the polar ice cap is literally melting.
And this is why we like to call it climate change as opposed to global warming. I mean, quite frankly, the whole planet is warming up. But at a given place on the planet, again, going back to these data points, which in the grand scheme of things are immaterial, hotter weather may cause in one place may cause warm air to rise, as we see with kettles or whatever when we're cooking, but eventually that air will cool as it gets towards space and fall somewhere else, and it's going to be cold at that point, and it's going to be rising and falling faster and harder. And so hurricanes, tidal waves, all sorts of other things are going to become more and more extreme. So And the extremity is really the thing that, as a human, sort of scares me. Look at when we grow our corn crops. We have to have a whole summer of basically perfect weather in order for these annual corn plants to grow. All it takes is one nasty hailstorm or one bad flood or 3 weeks of drought. And all of a sudden, you and I don't have any corn to eat. And as we know, corn is sort of the basis of our food economy here in the United States.
Yeah, and also the basis of my jokes in some cases. But that's a whole other thing. All right, so, gosh, there's several questions I have here all at once. So I want to talk about us, why this all matters to us, but this is why I paused. I also want to know, I mentioned the polar bears.
Sure.
Does it matter to us that other creatures on the planet are beginning to feel this? And maybe they're sentinels. Maybe that's the right way to put it. So amphibians in particular and many reptiles, turtles, tortoises, are telling us, if you're paying attention, that something's wrong.
Well, you know, you bring up turtles. We do a lot of work with turtles at the Notabart Nature Museum. We work with Blanding's turtles, which are an endangered species throughout much of the country, including here in Illinois. And we do head starting. We try to take baby turtles and raise them up and release them. And this will augment the populations, and eventually the species will be around and people can enjoy it. But importantly, for many, many reptiles, including turtles, there's what's called temperature-dependent sex determination. And what this means is that if the eggs incubate at below about 80 degrees, they're going to turn out to be boys. And if they incubate at above about 80 degrees, they're going to turn out to be girls. Now, that's something that kind of blows people's minds from a human perspective, because our sex is determined by our genetics. Turtles and many reptiles don't work that way. So and also, we think about 1 degree. You know, maybe your grandpa yells at you if you turn the thermostat down by 1 degree. But for the most part, we don't really care what the temperature is, plus or minus a couple of degrees. Baby turtles care. And if we raise the summer temperature for just a couple of days by 1 degree above average, we could end up having all girl turtles floating around, which would then result in eventually no more turtles.
Or really kinky turtles. I'm not sure.
Well, with sexual species, you've got to have both sexes here to make babies. And
is that how it works? I have no idea.
That's a different show. But then we look at the role that these turtles play in the ecosystem. And as you're saying, sentinel organisms, as particular organisms start to react differently to this, we see the ecosystem starting to break down. And, you know, a lot of times people say to me, you know, Steve, Blanding's turtles, they're cute and whatever, but what good are they to me? I don't really care.
Well,
to some extent, I might say, yeah, fine. You know what? They're smiley, they're cute, they're photogenic, but you're right. They don't really mean anything to you. They have no use to you whatsoever. Now, if I really want to argue the point, I might say, okay, well, Blanding's turtles, you know, they manipulate the habitat in this certain way, and thus they are, you know, they prevent floods in your backyard or something like this. And you can say that for a lot of species, but quite frankly, most species probably don't have any use to humans.
Well, I'd argue that. I'd say that they may not directly, but they have use to other species, and those species have use to other species, and eventually it does roll back up or down to us.
So, and a lot of times you can say that, but let's think about horses, or something that everybody's familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
1700s, 1800s, horses were indispensable to humans.
Yeah.
These days we have these horseless carriage gadgets. Who needs a horse? And in fact, many cities are banning horses because that horse feces, you know, the two or three piles that the horses leave behind are disgusting. Imagine our cities back in the 1800s, you know, horse feces was one of the major smells of a city.
I'm sure.
Right?
You knew where you were in a big city, apparently, because you could smell it.
You did. Yeah. And we forget about these things. But today, we can kind of say that horses are, they're cool.
Well, I suspect the people in an urban area are concerned about the welfare issue of the horses, too.
Sure.
So it's the animal activists who say, well, the horses are out too many hours, or they're out when it's too cold or too warm. I mean,
well,
that's as much of an issue as anything else, which is sort of beside the point of where we're going. So what can we learn by the turtles and by amphibians and by the polar bears and their changes? In some cases, these animals are dying out.
Mm-hmm.
Not only may I would argue that it matters to us, and I suspect at the end of the day you would too, but what do we learn from that? And are they sentinels?
Well, they certainly are sentinels, and they're sentinels that tell us that the world is changing in a way that is going to be different than we've ever seen before, which as humans we might not necessarily care about. But as we watch the trajectory and the speed that these things are changing, we realize that it's not just going to be different, it's going to be catastrophic. Our species has lived in a relatively benign, relatively stable period in Earth's history where we could farm a lot of food, we can live in a lot of places by doing relatively simple things to protect ourselves. One really cool thing about humans is we can use what's called non-metabolic energy. If you think about all these other animals on the world, the only energy that they have is energy that they eat and burn inside themselves. If they want to go from the ground floor to the top floor, they have to walk. But we can burn oil or coal to make electricity and run an elevator. This is non-metabolic energy. And so a lot of times these changes that are going on around us, we just turn up the air conditioner and we don't even notice it because we're using this external non-metabolic energy. But all those cool birds that you love outside are, in some respects, cooking to death and they can't do anything about it. And this gets back to the reasons for conservation. You know, are they any good to us? Maybe, maybe not. We can look at something like a monarch butterfly. It doesn't feed anything significantly. It's not a significant pollinator. They're cool, and it would break our hearts. And a lot of companies would frankly have to change their logos if the monarch butterfly went extinct, right?
Well, or not necessarily, because they're also the God, it's the tip of my tongue, the butterfly that looks like
the viceroy.
Right, they look just like the monarch butterfly, so who would know?
Well, and that's true too. And sometimes we're so ignorant of things that we don't notice these sentinel animals that you're talking about, and we don't notice the changes.
So our monarch butterfly is disappearing.
Data that we have at the Nature Museum would demonstrate that monarchs, as contrasted with a lot of other butterfly species, are relatively secure.
Really? Good.
But they are something that we should be worrying about and thinking about and being proactive about. One of the cool things, Doug Tarrant at the Notabart Nature Museum studies monarch butterflies very intensively, and he's shown that the populations here in North America can predict the Mexican overwintering populations, but not vice versa.
Hmm.
And this has lots of interesting implications on the conservation of this species.
You have to probably explain that, like a lot of people in Chicago, monarchs go down to Mexico or I think also Central America. I'm not sure.
They go to Mexico, and there's also a population that goes to Pacific Grove, California.
Really?
Yeah.
Taxes are probably cheaper for them in Mexico. Tequila is better there.
That's right.
So they go to one of those two places, but if there's no habitat for them to go to or to feed on there, they're not coming back here.
And if we have one of these weird extreme weather events where they freeze to death, then they can't come back here. But one of the neat things is, as long as we have enough milkweed and some of these other things, the population, being insects, can increase very rapidly. And that brings me to the final point of why we should care about all this is we as humans, we can use this non-metabolic energy to help ourselves, at least in the very, very short term. But during that same short term where we're feeling okay, kicking back, turning on the AC, all these other animals are dying and indicating that the world is becoming a challenging place even for us as humans. And then we need to look at things and say, okay, maybe you're not very useful. Maybe you're not very pretty, but who am I as a species to look at you and say that? Say you're useless and you're worthless, you're ugly, and so you deserve to die. And to some extent, it comes down to ethics. Who are we to make these decisions? That we share a planet with this whole host of biodiversity that has potential to be useful for us and certainly has potential to enliven our spirits. And we should be good stewards of these things that we have so that we can learn if our paradigm is it has to be useful for me, so that we can learn that usefulness. But if it goes extinct today because we're dumping carbon and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we're never going to have that opportunity.
So what happens? Is it reversible? I mean, so when you hear the public officials talk about it, they say we have to do something about it. Well, right. At this point, can we do anything about it? And is it only the pollution you mentioned? Is it also cows? I mean, some say that it's inevitable that this was going to happen anyway, and we're not responsible for it, and we can't do anything about it.
Well, it's not inevitable. I mean, we can look at data and see that it's not inevitable. And I think pollution takes many forms. I think cows, frankly, are a form of pollution in the same way that cars are a form of pollution. And it's not just...
Are they significant enough? And you have to explain why I brought up cows, too.
Well, so cows and meat in general are an important factor in climate change. For a variety of reasons. Part of it is simply their flatulence, their effluence, you know. So car exhaust, cattle exhaust.
Can't we just feed Gas-X to cows? Would that solve the problem?
Well, you know, if we wouldn't feed them on concentrated animal feedlots and we wouldn't feed them corn and things like this, then to some extent that is a bit of a Gas-X for them. But the other thing is the amount of energy-intensive resources that are necessary to raise a pound of beef is significantly greater than it is to raise the equivalent pound of some vegetative-type food. And that makes sense if we think about it. Energy comes from the sun, it hits a plant first, and then eventually it has to go be more and more concentrated until it can feed meat. And so I would say finally people are getting on the bandwagon and saying, eating a little less meat per person is not just good for our own physiques and our own health and longevity, but it's actually good for the planet. This is something that is so easy and so intuitive to do. You know, 2 years ago, my family and I went the entire year, barring a couple of special event dinners that we had, you know, ham for Easter and whatever, eating nothing but wild raised meat, wild grown, wild hunted meat.
Mm-hmm. How did you get that?
Well, it was certainly a challenge. I mean, I had to take vacation time and have my kids spend a lot of time with me and network with a lot of friends. But more importantly, mm-hmm. is that I decreased the amount of meat that I ate. And so by increasing the amount of vegetation and international dishes in some cases, because they keep your, you know, they keep your palate fresh and fun. That allowed me then to eat, to decrease significantly the total amount of meat that I ate. And by decreasing the amount of meat I ate, I ultimately, the amount that I could get out of the wild mm-hmm. was sufficient.
But I don't know that everybody can do that or have the wherewithal to do that. So what are some things, if there is anything we can do?
Well, first of all, simply cutting meat. You don't have to eat wild meat, but just cut the meat. Another thing I like to say is the mantra reduce, reuse, recycle is out there, and it's very prominent. And I think it's great, and I totally support it. But as long as we're deep into a discussion like this, let me say that reuse and recycle can be a cop-out. We simply need to reduce, because if we've reduced, we don't have anything left to reuse or recycle.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into a woman the other day that was trying to talk somebody into buying some 50% off Christmas items. Well, because one, they're 50% off, and look, it's recyclable.
Mm-hmm.
But look at the energy that we put into making this little garbagey tchotchke in the first place.
That the person doesn't need. Yeah.
And need is an excellent thing. Here in America, our wants have really become our needs. And I love thinking about other countries and the things that they get by with. And one of the things I do in my home, I have a touchstone of 1776, just because it's easy, and then also 1857, because that's when the Academy was founded. And thinking, how did people live back then? Because certainly people were really smart back then. There were plenty of people that lived comfortably back then. And can I live the way that they did?
But they also only lived to the age of 50. You don't want to do that.
Well, maybe not. But for example, they didn't have air conditioning. You know, one of the great things about Washington, D.C. is if you don't have air conditioning, all the politicians have to go home. They can't screw things up.
Yes.
And And so in our house, we try not to use any kind of air conditioning. I think last year we went something like 270 days without any kind of heating, air conditioning, ventilation. Just opening and closing windows, behavioral modification to affect thermoregulation.
Okay, so I agree with all that in theory, but in America, this stuff's only going to go so far. At this point in time, we're not going to make a ton of changes. So more people are recycling. That's a good thing.
Sure.
But I don't know that we're going to have people not using air conditioning that live in Florida, for example, you know. So,
well,
and in fact, not only do they use air conditioning in Florida, it's freaking freezing. You walk into the hotel room that you stay at or into a movie theater in certain places like Arizona or Florida, and in Chicago it might be, I don't know, 68 degrees or there, I swear it's like 38 degrees.
Right.
I mean, you need a coat on to go to the theater even if it's 100 degrees outside. I don't get that, but that's the culture there. So I'm not sure that a lot of that is going to change overnight. Are there some things, bigger picture, that nations can do that really will affect climate change?
Well, sure. And I mean, as you say, change overnight, that's challenging. And that's really where the politicians can do good things, because that's what it takes, is legislation to change things overnight. You know, you think in the last 20 or 30 years, there have been a lot of changes that have been for the good that people thought would never happen. So some of these cultural changes, I'm sure eventually we can convince everybody around the world to keep their theaters at 70 degrees or heaven forbid, even just turn off the HVAC and live with it. But that will take time. But there are a variety of protocols that governments have tried to enact and things that they've tried to do. And those are the things that, at least in principle, I support. Now, there's details of the practice that you question. But the other thing I think we need to do is, yeah, China and India are significant contributors to climate change and the pollution and stuff like that. But hey, you know what? That's them. Let's think about us for a second. What are we going to do? And let's not make this, well, you guys do 50%, we're going to do 50%. Let's do 100% of what we can do. And let's encourage everybody else to do 100% too. And let's be an example, a national example of recycling, sure, but even reducing what we buy. These bag bans are great. Lack of packaging would be great. Some of the central markets that you see popping up in towns, you know, here are the Green City Market that meets throughout winter at the at the Nature Museum. You don't need any packaging. You can literally touch and smell your food before you take it home, as opposed to having it in some hermetically sealed bag. These are all great changes that can happen both at a legislative level and at a personal level.
So tell me again the name of the exhibit.
The name of the exhibit is From Weather to Climate, Our Changing Planet. It opens April 2nd at the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum.
Okay, so by the time you hear this, it probably will be open. I want to talk about some other things, too, because the Nature Museum has this rich, glorious history. Isn't it one of the oldest museums in Chicago?
Yeah, we've started the 160th anniversary celebration here. It started a little bit early, but we are one of the oldest scientific institutions in the nation. There are a handful that were founded before us, but we were often...
The original name, Academy of Sciences, really does describe what the mission was, and to some degree, I believe, still is.
It absolutely still is. We are the urban gateway to nature and science. We want you to be able to look in your backyard and understand what's going on here, to appreciate your neighbors, whether they're human or animal or plant, and to understand how they're interacting with the world and how you, as an individual, are impacting their interactions with the world. Back in 1857, our purview extended from the western frontier of the United States, i.e. Chicago, all the way up into Russian America, later known as Alaska, all the way down into Florida. We were here before the Chicago Fire, and in fact, a lot of our stuff got burned in the Chicago Fire, and we rebuilt after that.
The backyard, you're in Lincoln Park.
Right.
The original location in Lincoln Park as well. I believe the backyard was used as a cemetery for people burnt in the fire.
At our old Clark Street location.
Yeah.
That's true, yeah. And actually, when we were at that Clark Street location, there's a guy named Frank Baker who went through and cataloged all the snails of Illinois and described new species. So in fact, if you can look at a snail in your backyard and say, I know that species, it's because Frank Baker at the Chicago Academy of Sciences told you.
And you can see butterflies now if you go there. So if you go to... I don't know, 20. I'm making up that number, but some number of museums around the country or in this hemisphere or facilities, mm-hmm. they have butterfly gardens and you walk in and butterflies are flirting all over.
Yeah.
The same thing here at the Nature Museum. What is it about butterflies?
Well, butterflies are cool. And there are a handful of places around the country that you can go to see live flying butterflies. But let me tell you, without bias, we have the best flight. That is the most butterflies on the wing flying around near your face for you to look at. Anywhere that I've ever been outside of places like Costa Rica.
You have the blue morphs?
We have blue morphos. We have rice papers.
Those are the big ones, too.
Yeah. Oh, we had an Atlas moth the other day that was literally bigger than my head.
Real, not bigger than my head. Notice how we said that.
And we also at the Nature Museum, we breed endangered species that we re-release out into restored habitats here throughout the Chicagoland region.
And that's huge. So and also you participate in all sorts of science that's done in Cook County, mm-hmm. Around the Chicago area, but nationally too. Participated at one time with Jane Goodall and her chimpanzee work, you know,
oh, yeah.
back in the day. Let's talk about urban wildlife a little bit.
Okay.
One of the reasons why I have personally a reptile at home is it brings for me a little of the wild world into the concrete world, which I live every day. Dogs and cats do that to some extent, but they're just like us in some ways. I mean, they're domestic animals, you know?
Sure.
So is there something to that, do you think?
Yeah, I think there is. You know, I have a cat at home. My daughter has a pair of rats, but she also has a Dumeril's boa.
Okay, and, but rats are great pets, actually.
Oh, they're wonderful pets,
yeah.
And especially for kids. Rats, I mean, our cat is really cool, but quite frankly, the rats are better pets for the kids than the cats in many respects.
Why do you think that?
Well, they're...
You know you're going to get the letters on this one.
Oh, I know. And it's certainly, there can be two camps, and I'm party to both camps here.
Yeah.
But you know, we have a pair of female rats, and they're very interactive with the kids. You can do training and things like this. And certainly, there's lots of personality variances on both species. But to see the way the kids can interact with these rats just after school very quickly, they're small enough to be cuddled, they can kind of come when they're called, so you don't really have to worry about them running away. They're not going to bite you or scratch you or claw you or anything. And
well, cat won't do that.
Well, some cats might. I mean, they might get annoyed with you.
No, don't say that to me. But you know what? The sad part about having a rat is they only live a couple of years. That's the sad.
Well, that is a sad part, but quite frankly, from a parent's perspective, that's also the great part.
It teaches kids? Is that where you're going? Or?
Well, I'm going because kids' attention spans are short. And quite frankly, I expect my kids are going to be interested in animals forever. But if they're not, it's okay because... nobody's going to be saddled with the care of this animal, and you can humanely keep an animal for 3 years, even if you hate the thing. But you know, yeah. if it's going to live for 50 years, if you get a ball python, and you end up not liking ball pythons, it can suffer for years and years before it dies.
And that's part of the reason why the Chicago Herpetological Society is around. Mm-hmm. Sadly, a part of the mission of the Herp Society is to find homes for these reptiles that seem really cool for people to buy today. But then a couple of days later or weeks or years later, they find out that turtle, in fact, can live, or tortoise, 35 mm-hmm. years.
Well, you know, and that's true. And we do try to find homes for things, but we try to be more proactive than that even. And one of the things that's coming up soon is Reptile Fest. And this is the nation's largest educational reptile and amphibian show. And the main goal of this is we want people to get into this 40,000 square foot facility at Northeastern Illinois University and be able to get on hands-on with these species and see what they're really like when they're adults, talk with the individuals who are taking care of these all the time, and learn, you know, are you going to be able to supply what this animal needs? You know, I often tell people that if you've had a box turtle that you've owned and it's died while you've owned it, there's a good chance that it died because you screwed up and you tortured it to death, because turtles are so resilient and so tough that they can live years with insufficient food and insufficient ultraviolet light and things like this. So come to Reptile Fest April 9th and 10th and see what these things require so that you can have something that's not just a cool animal, but a friend who will cuddle with you and enjoy life with you and make, as you're saying, make life a little more wild and intellectually stimulating in a really fun way.
That's at Northeastern Illinois University, 3600 West Foster, mm-hmm. on Chicago's north side. It's April 9th and 10th, and that's put on by the Chicago Herpetological Society.
And the other cool thing about the Chicago Herpetological Society is they meet once a month, the last Wednesday of the month, at the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum, 7:30 p.m. Everybody's invited. This is one of the great things that the Nature Museum provides to the community, is all sorts of activities like that. We've also got a native plant sale coming up in May, and we do things like Tea with the Turtles, which is a great time for kids and parents to get together and learn about turtles.
Yes, it is. You know, I was the last person ever to do – so the Lincoln Park Zoo – we're running out of time here, I know. But the, I could talk to you forever. But the Lincoln Park Zoo used to do a tea party in the children's zoo. I was the last person to do it. And I'll tell you why I was the last person. That they brought, what they did is they pulled a great ape, often a chimp, but it could have been an orangutan or gorilla from its mom.
Oh,
and then they brought up these animals in the children's zoo. That's what they did then.
Sure.
Which today would appropriately be frowned upon.
Well, it's a cultural change.
Yeah.
Good things happen. There,
yeah, and it did happen. So the last chimp to be pulled was named Chimmy, and I was the last person to participate in what was a Chicago tradition at the time,
the
chimpanzee tea party, and Chimmy would pull me out on a Red Flyer wagon, and it was a young chimp, but that's how strong they are, right?
Right, absolutely.
Hugely, I mean, very strong, and would have no problem with one finger pulling me out on the wagon. I would get up. I would talk about chimpanzees for a while. We used to do, I don't remember, I'd shake hands with Chimmy. Chimmy would then sit in the wagon, and I'd pull Chimmy back, and we got laughs. And then I would come out with a ferret or a Arctic fox or something.
Sure.
And it was a lot of fun. But your tea parties are a little different.
Well, and that's the thing. You know,
there's no chimpanzees.
There's no chimpanzees, but part of the reason that events like that were popular back then, and similarly, they're still popular today, is connecting physically with animals brings something special to our spirits.
They do, don't they?
And, you know, exploiting a primate like that, taking it from its mom, habituating it to become a human, that's kind of a different issue than being able to provide a great habitat for a turtle and letting it live its life out in comfort and ease and safety in a warm and loving home, and then being able to physically bond with these animals. And that's one of the special things that we can do at things like Tea with the Turtle or Reptile Fest, or even at the Nature Museum daily with our critter connections, where we physically bring out snakes or spiders or different things and let you touch them.
You have a turtle with you, actually, because you're a parent. You always travel, I believe, with a turtle or a snake.
Something living, because it's because of that connection. You know, you look at this guy and you look in his eyes and there's something that you learn about animals when you look that closely at them and you're able to really sort of touch them. There's a connection that we make that, you know, going back to our discussion
What kind of turtle is this?
This is an ornate box turtle, which is actually a threatened species here in Illinois because of habitat destruction.
And how old is he or she?
This one is older than we know. We got it as a rescue. When you look at the ridges on its shells and things like that, it is easily 40 years old, you know, maybe more than that. One of the neat things about box turtles is they often are reproductively more successful the older they get.
Really?
And that really tells you something a lot about their biology. You know, in a sexual species, you only have to have two offspring survive in order to keep the population at stasis after mom and dad die. Well, if this turtle is being more successful when it gets older, that means it's that much more important for it to be having babies when it's older. So if we see turtles in the wild, it's really important to leave them there because chances are they have not yet been replaced by their offspring. And if they disappear, then the population will plummet.
Well, I could add to that. There are other reasons, too, and you're unlikely to provide care at home unless you really know what you're doing, appropriate care.
That's one of the reasons that the Chicago Herpetological Society exists, is to really give a good support structure, both technically and socially, to get together with people who are keeping these effectively and also who are breeding them. Because, you know, they can make great pets for people who are invested in it, but you should only buy them from breeders, just like dogs and cats. You don't go buying puppy mill turtles.
I don't know of any puppy mills that breed turtles, but I get the gist
of
what you're saying. Yeah. So, well, there is actually.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, the red-eared sliders, for example.
Red-eared sliders, sulcatas. There are lots of species that are just bred simply for people making money.
But not that one. And she is so good-looking. So you say she's about 40 or 35 years old?
Probably somewhere like that, but quite frankly, that's a guess. She's ancient.
Oh, she's Botox, maybe. That's what it is. She looks great, I'll tell you.
Antioxidants every day in her blueberries and strawberries and everything.
But animals like this, I think, are important because, as I said, they bring a little of the wild world into our concrete world, for one thing. For another thing, there's this fascination. Working at the zoo at one point, I know that. You tell me if you've had the same experience. Little kids especially just stop, and it could be a turtle, it could be anything living other than another human. They'll stop and they'll watch and they will ask questions.
And we do see that mostly in kids, but that's just because adults are too jaded. If we keep our childlike curiosity and if we are constantly learning about the world, that's one of the great things about animals. You know, everybody says, there's lots of studies that fish tanks are ever so soothing to people.
It's true.
And they are. And you sit there and you watch them and you see all sorts of personalities. Even if you have five goldfish that all look exactly the same, you watch them long enough and you'll see those are five individuals with different personalities, different desires and tastes, different places in this tiny little fish tank that they like to be. Mm-hmm. And you make connections with the world through these animals, and also as you look at them, you realize what their needs are. And that's one of the reasons that there are a lot of species that are not kept in captivity or that are not used in shows, like the chimpanzees and things, because we simply can't provide effective husbandry for them. The best place for most of these animals is in the wild, in intact habitats that we as humans at this point need to make conscious decisions to preserve.
Great way to end it on. For those in the Chicago area or who are coming to Chicago, where is the museum?
The museum is at 2430 North Cannon Drive. That's just right off Lakeshore Drive at Fullerton.
Just north of the zoo.
North of the zoo, yeah. And we're open from 9 to 5 every day. We have wonderful outdoor exhibits. We mentioned the butterfly haven, where you'll see more butterflies flying around than anywhere else. Sometimes we're doing live taxidermy. We oftentimes have live animal shows. And, of course, not to be missed is our new and world premiere of our weather exhibit, From Weather to Climate, Our Changing Planet.
Excellent. Steve Sullivan, it's been too long, but it's always good to talk to you. Thank you, and thank Hilda. That's the turtle, right?
Right.
Very much for coming. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.